Alright guys, welcome back to the Casual Convos podcast, a series dedicated towards economics and finance. In today's episode, we have Ethan Yee as a guest, a qualified financial planner at TD Bank in Canada. What he does, in short, he's the guy that advises clients based on their criteria on investment and retirement.
Funnily enough, we used to go to the same high school together, and we talked about his youth, how he ended up in Canada, what factors he considers before setting up a portfolio, and how he lost even more money than his clients during the March stock market crash.
One last thing before we jump into the episode. Everything said by Ethan expresses his own opinions and view and does not necessarily equate to the views of his employer. As always, all the links can be found in the description below or on convos.com. And if you have any questions for Ethan, he has graciously made himself available. You can contact him through his website profile in the description below. And of course, if you have any questions for us, feedback, or possible guest suggestions, feel free to reach out in the links mentioned in the descriptions as well. This podcast is available on all standard podcasting platforms such as iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and for video, you can check out YouTube and TreeSpeak. All right, guys, we're back with another episode of Casual Convos with Greg, Diego, and Tim. And we have a special guest today all the way from Canada, Ethan Yee. He's an investment banker at TD America, right? Yeah.
TD White House, actually, yeah.
TD White House. All right, thanks for that correction. And we're just going to have a quick talk about him, you know, about his job, what he does, get another perspective. We've had previous episodes where we talked about the different dynamics in economics, cryptocurrency, investing in general, but it's good to hear it from someone inside and their perspective on it. Short intro for Ethan. I think you already know Greg, but I've met Greg a few years ago. We know each other from previous encounters, but I've recently found out that he's a certified technical analyst. I'm also a good friend of mine. He got me into cryptocurrency. I'm currently studying in New Zealand, doing a postgrad in business, and I have interest in design, but also recently finance, investing, and the markets in general. And if there's anything we missed on you, feel free to give us a short intro on yourself, if that's possible.
Yes, please.
That's your cue, Ethan.
Okay, for me, okay. Yeah, you know, a little bit about me is that born in China, raised in Suriname after my teenage years, and then like I went to college here in Canada, studying finances and investments, and now working at TD Bank under their wealth management unit, TD Waterhouse, TD Financial Planning. So my job really is to help retail clients, mass affluent and high net worth clients relating to their financial planning needs in terms of like, you know, retirement, tax planning, estates planning, and then also government benefits within the Canadian tax structure. I'm more focused on the financial planning side where I utilize my team of specialists on the investment, you know, like a management side of TD to do most of the investing. So that's kind of like my line of expertise, I would say.
Okay, cool. Great.
So let's take it back a bit. Born in China, raised in Suriname, teenage years, moved to Canada. To tell us, let's talk about that journey. How did you end up from China to Suriname and then decided to go to Canada?
What were the driving factors? So I basically got kidnapped as a kid by my parents, like to go to Suriname because I didn't really have a choice because they were moving there. So, you know, met my good friend Greg, you know, over there in high school, actually, where we spend most of the time, you know, like fighting with our teachers, I would say. And you know, as a ten year old, you know, going to Suriname, you know, like for me, it was like I would say a bit of a struggle first couple of years. I couldn't speak English, couldn't speak Dutch, so like I had to learn a lot, you know, through my roots, which is like Mandarin and Cantonese. So like using my Chinese language to learn a foreign language and then eventually learn English. I think for most first generation immigrants as myself, a lot of the decision were not driven by like, you know, us knowing what to do. It's more by, okay, my parents is going there, so we're going with them. And then the second step to Canada was that it was more like a personal choice for me, because like it was either between like Holland and Canada. At the time, I didn't know there was a treaty between Suriname and Holland regarding to the, you know, tuition situation. So otherwise, I would have gone there, actually. But, you know, I chose Canada, you know, upon my research on, you know, the type of like, immigration system that they had in place, and that I kind of had a grasp on, you know, whether or not I can, you know, I would say like a stay. Because a lot of people don't get to stay usually when they go, you know, abroad to study. So that was some of my concerns too. So that's how I came up with, you know, choosing Canada in Toronto as, you know, like where I base my studies. And why I choose finance was, you know, Toronto is one of the biggest finance hubs in North America. So that's another, you know, factor, you know, when I thought about my career path that I wanted to go to. So that's how I, you know, end up choosing, you know, learning about finance, investment, financial planning, insurance, and things like that.
Before you left to go abroad, to study abroad in college, you already knew that you weren't coming back to Suriname, because you actively sought out universities and countries where you were allowed to stay after you graduated. Wow.
And I kind of had that in mind. Yeah.
And I gotta say, I didn't know you were Chinese, and I didn't know you came here when you were 10. Because the language barriers between a 10-year-old and coming to a completely new country, I had no idea. I had no idea that you started speaking Dutch after you were 10. I would have never guessed. I mean, we met when we were like 15, 16, I guess. I would have had no clue that you came from China a few years ago. All right, no, good. Good to know, man. Yeah. Lots of dedication.
That is quite quickly.
quite interesting to figure out here, right, Greg? So you deliberately chose like finance. Is there a specific reason why that sector like really interested you? Anything happened in the past or things you've seen that drew you to that industry?
I think it was like initially it was more like a career development, like a thought process on like, I initially came here on a business degree. And then like halfway through, you know, I did some more research, you know, relating to the job markets, you know, and other things surrounding, you know, like my studies. And I kind of knew that, you know, like with business degrees is so broad in a sense that, you know, a little bit of everything, but like nothing specialized. So in order for me to kind of like, you know, sell myself to employers and, you know, and also think about certain fields that are widely available, you know, hiring people all the time. Those were kind of like the driving factors into like me changing my, I would say specialty, like at the third semester. So I did the first two and then like general studies, you know, did well over there and kind of like just sat down and really thought about it, you know, end of second semester to see, okay, well, do I want to like make a change or do I want to continue this path and then, you know, let it lead, you know, me into whatever. But I, you know, deliberately choose to go into finance, specialized, you know, in insurance, you know, financial planning and insurance, like in investment. So that way I felt more secure going into the job force. That was really like a, I would say initial decision. But as I, you know, continue to study more about the markets, the more about, you know, investment in general, and also, you know, the type of job that I'm going to be, you know, doing, like when I'm done with school, that attracted me more, because like I know that I'm going to be focusing on, like, you know, working with individuals, families, all businesses relating to, you know, like tax management, investment management, and also financial planning. So that's something that, you know, I still enjoy, you know, day to day. So that would be, yeah, my continued kind of like motivation to keep working as, you know, what I'm doing right now.
All right. So the official title that you have is Certified Financial Planner. Am I right?
Right now, Qualified Financial Planner, yes. But I'm doing my certification end of this year, where I'm going to get the CFP designation, yes.
Uh-huh. Great. So that says that you help clients set up a portfolio and you gauge based on whatever their risk parameters are, and then you suggest to them a sort of portfolio structure. You're not the analyst that makes the stock picks, right?
Yeah, sure. So I think for me, it's like when I meet with a client, right? Like, so most of what you said is right. But like when I meet with a client, there will be processes in place. For example, if I'm going to, you know, talk to them about, you know, what they actually want to achieve, you know, I can kind of find out, okay, is this a tax management issue? Is this an investment issue? Or this is a financial planning issue? And then, you know, when it comes down to the core of investments, do they want to do it themselves, or they want to have, you know, rely on a part, you know, like a two specialists to do it? So that makes a difference, right? Because like, we have different lines of businesses suitable for different kind of people. So if they still want financial planning component to what they are doing, but while in the meantime, they want to do their own trades, I will refer them to another specialist, you know, in the direct investing channel. So that would be how I do it. And then like after the discovery, you know, meeting, then I will have kind of like a base plan set up for their, whether it be retirement, tax planning, estates, insurance, investment, things like that. And then as we evolve into the process, the plan also evolves with the client. And then that's how I kind of work with them, you know, throughout day after day, year after year, and things like that.
Mm, okay, great.
Just so it's more like a process rather than like a,
Just for some clarification, dumb question. What would be the differences being a qualified associate and being certified in the title? Is there certain privileges that a certified individual has?
I would say like at this, in terms of the titles differences, I think a qualified financial planner versus a certified financial planner would be the level of complexity a financial planner is involved. Yes, yeah, so the level of complexity that, you know, like, you know, a qualified financial planner versus a certified financial planner. Certified financial planners deal with the highest level of complexity, like of financial planning within Canadian soil, basically. And that has to do with businesses to personal, to a person with business and personal stuff, to holding companies, to corporations, and so forth. So it's some more technicalities, you know, if you ask me. But that's my understanding, you know, between the two. And now I'm doing, you know, the second part. I'll let you know when I'm done next year.
Great. Awesome. All right. You told me a fascinating story about how you got recruited straight out of college to work over there. Right. I was wondering if you could tell the audience what exactly happened, because that's pretty cool.
Okay. So I guess, you know, like that happened kind of at, I would say last semester of college. What I did was already looking around for jobs and applying and such, but I haven't been hearing back from, you know, like a lot of employers at the time. Like most of them would just send me email to fill in some personal information, and that was it. So what I did was to one of the employers that I actually applied to, I just went into a seminar of a local advisor that worked for this firm called Edward Jones. They're a licensed both in the States and here in Canada. One of the biggest brokers actually in Toronto. And I basically attended his seminar, listened to what they had to say about, you know, type of job they did. And then I kind of, you know, invited him to do a interview with me for my schoolwork. And then it's actually for my HR course, actually, about like, you know, interviewing someone in the field that you want to work in. And then after that, what I did was constructed about 20 different questions relating to the field and also what they do. And in the meantime, also sell myself, you know, as like a fresh graduate about like my knowledge, about like my business management, like, you know, skills that I kind of developed, you know, when I was working for my parents back in Suriname, you know, in the boutique, and, you know, kind of like sold myself on, you know, what I know versus what they did. And that, I guess, went well, I would say. And he also wrote me like a recommendation letter to the central HR department. And that's when, you know, like, you know, they started calling me regarding this, you know, financial advice offer. It was kind of like a training program that kind of morph you into a, you know, like ready to work financial advisor in the investment field, whether it be, you know, bonds, stocks, mutual funds, and ETFs, like train me on all of those. So that's kind of like how I got my first job at college.
Nice.
Like something straight out of a movie.
So I basically went and went to his house almost, well, to his office, and then like asked for a job, basically.
Wow. But it's interesting. You said you actively sold yourself, which is contrary to the normal way people view this, as you just get a job, you get offered a job, but you actively marketed yourself to get that job. You made it impossible for them not to take you, right? So
in a sense, yes.
So you're not even finished with college. So how do you actively sell yourself to go into investment banking of all places, where I'm sure there are thousands of people who want it more than you, but instead they did pick you? What's the difference? What happened?
I guess it's not as hard, I would say, like to get a job offer. But the thing is that how do you pass that, you know, like that stage of actually getting an interview? So that would be like the harder part. And like through my, you know, like 2-3 years of like looking for jobs, like from local companies, and like not getting a single call back or like an email back and whatnot, my mind was kind of like going, okay, well, how do I get these people's attention? And like the only thing that I can get their attention, and I read a lot of like YouTube videos or like online posts about this too, you know, to prepare myself right for these like kind of encounters, is that and it's just like my job too, is like at every opportunity you have to show your value to the client so that they want to continue to work with you, whether it be a, you know, like a simple thing as, you know, oh, okay, well, you have to be a self-starter to work at this job. In my previous roles, when I was helping my parents, we actually had to be proactively looking into solutions to prevent things from happening, to train our sales staff, and to manage our business. So that's kind of like the things that I relate to. Oh, I have to run my own brokerage office. Well, I had these kind of experiences. Oh, I have to make a sale. I used to be, you know, helping training my sales staff into selling clothes, for example. I have these different kind of skill sets, but that, you know, may not be applicable to this industry, but I have the knowledge to apply it. And kind of, you know, in that way was, you know, like that wow moment, right? As, you know, like the guy saying that, okay, well, you know, didn't expect, you know, someone coming out of college to have all these different kind of experiences, but like if you're willing to try And then he did warn me about this. It's like, it's a really hard job, you know, to learn and to, you know, get clients out of nowhere and to study for exam. Like all these three combined together was my first 3 months of work. So, you know, he warned me about it and I still went through with it. You know, luckily I survived the whole process. But I guess at the end of the day is that, you know, nobody's going to give you a chance, right? Unless you give yourself a chance. So if you wait for someone else to give you a chance, then like, what does that make you differently than the guy that's begging for money on the street? Like in my mind, right? So like for me, it's more like, okay, how do I proactively solicit myself to like different employers? Like if I get the platform to do it, like, and if I know that I've been getting like so many no's in the, you know, previous encounters already, you know, that I have to just, you know, do whatever I need, you know, in order to get this position or like another position or whatever the case may be. So I just try my hardest to not sound too cringy while selling myself, and that worked, I would say, luckily. So that's basically my mindset around that. Yeah.
Okay. Great approach, I must say. It seems you spent a lot of time as well, aside from your like the technical side of study, investing in a lot of your personal development in building rapport with people. And I think that's the thing, right? Building that relationship before getting in there. So, and
yeah,
relating to them in a way with your past experiences. And that got your foot into the door because it was different.
Right.
Because other people don't do that.
Right. So like that really got my foot into the door. And what's coming, I didn't expect, but like it was, three interactions with HR personnel, like to basically evaluate your own work versus the mental state that I was in. And then like finally with the HR manager to kind of like, they literally say this, like, you're going to probably hear like 100 people say no to you every day. Like, are you okay with that mentally? Right, things like that. And then afterwards going into like a professional development, more interviews with like regional, like management teams on, you know, like business plan building and building your 3 years, 5 years and 10 year business plan in your market area. How do you market yourself? Things like that. And the craziest thing is that even without any previous experience in being a banker or advisor and never had the opportunity to, well, I did in a way, but I never really had the opportunity to like be fully licensed, you know, as an investment advisor. They ask you to go through a day in the life of a financial advisor. So what happens is it's a 6-hour assessment that they hire actors from the States to test you on. And in the morning, you will get the, you know, introduction of the company, what we do. And then from there, you have your own clients, you have prospects, and you have leads. So leads are people that you never spoke to. Prospects are the people that already know you, and you have your own clients to manage. So how do you divide your time, right, within a 3-hour period? And then there's like a halftime report. So they're going to tell you, okay, what you did well and what you didn't do well. And then second 3 hours, you know, you have to commit, I mean, like work with a prospect that's in, you know, interested into working with you, but you have to have a phone conversation, kind of like a phone meeting with him. For me, out of college, that was like a bit of a challenge for sure. But like, so I didn't do well in the first half, but I did okay in the second half. So they let me in. So that was kind of like the whole process, you know, it was around like 6 to 8 weeks in total for the whole interview process. So after that, my training starts for real. So that was pretty hefty.
So they gauged your ability to handle clients before they actually taught you the intricate details of stock picking, yes, of portfolio construction. Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's pretty cool.
Or like what kind of conversation, or like even what kind of conversation you have, right? So like now, you know, like with closed eyes, I know what to say to clients. But at that time when I was still in school, like they didn't even kind of like teach you how to talk to clients. or how to talk to them relating to their finances or planning needs and things like that. But I had to do that within that time frame, within the one day. It's just escalated learning curve, basically. I'm just, happy I survived.
In other words, they just threw you to the deep end of the pool and see if you could make it out on your own.
Right. Are you gonna sink or swim? Basically, they want to see under pressure. They also throwing a complaint in there. in the middle of the whole assessment, someone was calling me to complain about something that I need to get back to right away. And then I think the hardest part was to make sense of, okay, why you did certain things first versus certain things last. What was your motive around it? What is your thinking around it? And when you talk to these prospects, what is going through your mind? Why do you say certain things versus the other? Soft skills and technical skills were tested, basically.
And having gone through that whole process and now actually being in the position to get clients, what was your experience onboarding your first client? How did that go?
I can't remember. I can't remember the first client, I would say. I remember first time going to a stranger's door and to knock on it. I still remember that street number and that street in the intersection and what I said and what the lady said. Because part of my training was that they will kind of in training centers with actors and coaches and things like that to teach you, for example, when you are at someone's front door, what do you say, how do you introduce yourself, and also how do you market yourself and things like that. So it was a in the afternoon somewhere in 2016 towards the end of the year, on the street. So I knock on this person's door and I just held a flyer in my hand. I go, my name is Ethan Ye, local financial advisor. I'm just going to be opening a branch in the near future around your area. These are, what we do. And then she looks at me, she's like, okay, I'm not interested. And then she closed the door and I was just still talking there at the door. I just kept talking. I was so nervous. I just kept talking and then I stopped after a while and I'm like, okay. And then that was kind of the experience of me, going through, talking to strangers and soliciting yourself, for the first time, in my life. So that was kind of that was pretty hard.
what does a default conversation look like? Because I can imagine when someone comes to your front door asking you if you want to buy something, the standard answer isn't no. And it's probably no, go away, leave me alone. Right. And you gotta process that, and you just gotta keep on going. Everyone tells you just stay away. But how does that go?
You just take it one by one, usually. On a daily basis, in the beginning, I probably visit 100 to 200 doors, from businesses to homes to walking, right? And walking in the neighborhood. A standard conversation would be, I later changed my style, I would say. In the beginning, it was more about the emphasis of, okay, I work for Edward Jones. And I'm opening, I'm working in an office close by and, I wanted to, let you know that, things like that and what I'm doing. Later on, it became much more about more casual, I'm coming from this investment company and I was doing monthly seminars with banking portfolio managers and investment portfolio managers. So that would become easier talking point for me at that time. So I would just go in and be like, hey, you know what? I have monthly seminars. They are usually lunches close by. You can come and join and listen. I will have RBC, banks, portfolio manager coming, to talk a little bit about, current, strategies or portfolios or the current trends, into the investment. So that would be my account. My spiel, as you would say, basically just finding, I would say, the right clients, for the right kind of product. So, I have retirees that say, you know what, I don't even want to do stock market. Hey, don't worry, we have like guaranteed banking products for that, you know, things like that. Just making sure that, you know, we can kind of, in the sense of, you know, one, I got to find clients for my survival, but two, also, you know, find the right products for the right audience. Because oftentimes, you know, like at the bank, because they already bank clients, they might not pay as much attention to these clients compared to like, you know, brokerages. So that's why even now when I get clients from the branch, like I would say most of the time they are not properly diversified or like properly invested. So I have like the full suite of investment that's available, but at the warehouse side, even though we are same bank, but because I specialize in this area, so I can give them more offers, more choices, cheaper options, and things like that. So that really becomes the, you know, my go-to conversations. And then, you know, it depends on the client. So it's really no go-to, I would say, like just on the fly, how the conversation goes. Like you just need to know your stuff and, you know, whatever comes your way, just answer them.
So from going from looking like the early days, being like a pesky salesman at the door and evolving to, you know, finding their needs, pushing the right buttons. What are some common misconceptions that people generally have from what you do as a planner compared to the standard bankings and investment offices?
So previously when I was at Edward Jones, they were thinking that I wanted to steal their money from the bank. So that was a general misconception. And they also thought that, you know, like the person with the same title as me at the bank did exactly what I did. So they would often say, oh, I already have a financial advisor. But that's not it. Like, I don't deal with mortgages. I only specialize in investments. And that is an investment advisor in the banking side, which you need a million or more to enter the door. But here I'm giving you the same type of service at 50,000 or like 100,000 or whatever, things like that. So that would be like a main misconception. And then even now, you know, at the financial planning offer, people would say that, oh, I already have a, you know, guy that looks after my finances at the bank. And they don't know that we have different, like we are all great in our own field, but we have different tools in terms of like planning for retirement, for example, managing tax, you know, in retirement, for example, when you draw down your investment, what kind of tax is involved with different type of accounts. People at the branches, because they are a jack of all trade, they have to do mortgages, credit cards, open accounts, investment, you know, so a lot of the things are kind of like lost in the process where they have to go to do all these things separately for the client. Whereas me, I just specialize in, okay, if you're investing, these are kind of like the things that you need to look out for. If you have a regular account, you know, these are kind of like the taxes that you can expect, you know, at the end of the year from dividends, from income, from taxes, interest, things like that. So that would be like a general misconception, you know, like between what I do versus, you know, the person at the bank.
All right.
Cool.
All
right.
So what does your day look like right now? Because do you still actively sell house to house, or do clients come to you now? What's the deal?
So I think since I moved to the banking, you know, investment unit in 2018, right now I work with 1.5 branches, I would say. Initially, I started working with like 3 branches. What I do is like I train my advisors at these branches to kind of identify, you know, the right kind of clients that should come to this channel. For example, people with, you know, north of 250,000, and they are just invested at a branch at no extra cost. They can have a personalized financial plan, you know, already included into the, you know, the cost that they're already paying. So those are kind of like a thing, additional level of, I guess, due diligence from the bank side to make sure that their clients get the best value or at least that they know about it. And no, I don't go door to door anymore. But from time to time, I would like, for example, go to different seminars. For example, you know, if my school invites me to go have a talk with them, I'll go. If some mortgage specialists or like my bank managers that I, you know, partner with, you know, are going to an event where they might do a presentation, like I would be in charge for the investment and retirement portion of the invest, like the presentations. And also I would maybe go to like different balls from like you know, retirement homes, you know, professional groups, and also professional organizations, things like that. So that's really it. Like mainly referrals from the, you know, bank as their specialist within the branch.
Could you clarify one thing for us? So you are the investment previously an independent investment advisor, and now you're under a bank? Because I think I missed some.
Yes. So when I was working with Edward Jones, I was more in a private company. So over there, I actually ran my office with another senior financial advisor. So each of us has between like, I was managing about 200 families, and he was maybe managing about like 300 to 400 families. And then within the team, we have about like 3 to 4 associates doing like admin work, calling clients and things like that. So that was my previous role in a private, not publicly traded investment company that are based in Canada and States. Since 2018, I came over to TD Bank under their TD Bank investment unit. So over here, I basically work with branch teams as the primary financial planner, which is my title. And then like I work with branch teams to identify, for example, you know, the right type of clients that should, you know, like enjoy this kind of financial planning service, and then like coach them on, you know, what's happening on the market, you know, on the, you know, coach them on, you know, like products that they have at the bank side, and then also work out strategies to market, you know, like the business, and also make sure that, let's say if I meet someone and if they're more suitable for another channel at another advisor, I'll do that, you know, like send them their way. Or if they need like business banking, I have a business banking like advisor, you know, send it his way. Right now, that's kind of like my line of work. And I'll just to clarify, everything that I said is more of a personal opinion. It's not the statement of the bank. Just so I don't go into trouble.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So let's just take it a bit practical. Let's say I'm 25. I barely have any savings, a few thousand dollars, but I want to start now investing for retirement. I come to your office. How do you set me up? What kind of questions do you ask me?
So I think for everyone, it's pretty much the same thing that I kind of go through. So if you're 25, that means that, you know, retirement age here is about like 65. So you have like 40 years to invest. You know, that's like initial findings, right? And if you're 25 and you're here, like, are you a permanent resident here? Or are you like a Canadian citizen? Or are you a student here on abroad? So those kind of like are the things that will affect your retirement income from the government, right? And then from there, really just look into your like work, you know, your work history to kind of gauge understanding, and also let you know that, okay, well, if you're working since you're 18, and then you're going to continue working, well, what kind of money you can expect from the government in terms of like social security, you know, like of Canada. And then from there, really just to gauge understanding of your income level, how much you're okay to save, what kind of goals you have. If in the interim, you don't own your house yet, that might be something that you, you know, you might want to think about, right? So if you're going to purchase a house, that means that that might be your primary goal now, because your retirement is 40 years away. Right. And if that's not the case, then like, you know, then we can work towards things that, you know, give you some like tax efficient strategies relating to what you do, what kind of income you have, what kind of capacity you have in terms of like the different account types that you may or may not own already. And they just work a plan out, you know, and more focus on the plan first, because the investment side of things, like depending on my understanding of you, like we can find a good portfolio fully managed by portfolio managers, you know, whereas I will be more of a quarterback to your, like, you know, like the financial plan in place to make sure that, you know, the investment are working in your favor to get to where you want to be eventually, right? Whether it be purchasing your home, your retirement, and additional income, depends. So it's a long conversation for sure.
All right. So let's take the complete other end of the spectrum. Someone who's 60 mm-hmm. years old, he has no debt, his children are going off to college, he just wants to preserve mm-hmm. his wealth into his retirement. What would a person like that's portfolio look like?
I think the age factor is definitely there. So age factor meaning that he will probably be more income focused. That's definitely gonna be there. But like as you said, like he's 60, he's like has no debt. Is he still working? His kids are going to college. Does he want to keep something aside from them in their name, or like you know, with his name now, but then like they will be the beneficiary? Does he have like a charity that he wants to like donate to? Like that way you can save some taxes, right? You know, and then from there, really just gauge understanding of like his like expectations, you know, and also his like a risk, you know, a tolerance. And even going into the behavioral finance of things where, you know, he might behave a certain way in bad market conditions. So those are all the things that I will need to assess before, you know, we even go and really talk about investment, because investment is just, you know, the idea of, you know, me knowing everything about the client and then eventually choosing the right product, not just because, hey, you know what, I want 10%, what can you do for me? Well, I have 10% product, but if you pull the truck, like pull the plug, like, you know, this March, you probably will not make it, right? You know, if you behave a certain way, certain products are not right for you. So whether me giving you a high risk profile, I'll give you a balanced profile so that if you see that the money is not dropping that much, you will not, you know, like, you know, be so fast to sell it and capture your losses. So that way, over the long run, you'll keep more to yourself. You know, those are kind of like the things that we, like us that we face, like individual clients that we have to do, is that not only do we need the right product, but also the right product for the right client, right? If someone is very quick to react to market situations, like some of my, like, not even retired, like some of my 60-year-old, 50-year-old clients, they see that their portfolio dropped by 1%, they're calling me. So I know, okay, well, you need to go into like, wow, you know, retirement portfolio.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of those, right? Like power struggles, dealing with people, you know, knowing that we are imperfect in any ways, many ways, and just really deal with that. So yeah, I can't really go into like, you know, details on like investment because I need to know more before I can do anything. But definitely income focus for retirees.
Generally, what's the like financial literacy from most of the people that approach the office looking to invest? Do they have, is it like they have already have an idea of, or why would someone go to an investment, a financial planner, compared to, you know, going to a broker, opening an account on a brokerage himself and doing it themselves? Like, I'm trying to gauge the financial literacy in general and why people go to a bank or not.
Right. Okay, I think like my opinion is that people go to a bank because one, either they don't have time or they're not interested. Two, their knowledge is not to a state where they are comfortable managing their own money. And three is that some people are just lazy, right? They don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
Right. Like you have your time to do everything else in the world, whether it be doing the job that you like, to doing the hobbies that you like, or spend time with family. If this was not my job, I probably won't pay as much attention and time to it versus what I'm doing, you know, right now, because this is my job, right? So I'm supposed to be, you know, following the markets, knowing what's happening in the market, you know, in the world, world events, you know, market events, economic events, things like that. But, you know, to me, I think that most people do value advice in terms of, you know, even if they have great knowledge, you know, example is that a couple of months ago, I spoke to a gentleman, he and three other families combined with the wealth of around like 6 million Canadian dollars. He told me like specifically that it's not about the investment, because I can do that myself. I want the value of knowing that, you know, like tax planning is being done right, you know, the different, you know, like tax strategies are operating in my accounts, and also, you know, like a retirement plan and a financial plan relating to our own, you know, like needs, right? And each family, you know, like he knows that if he's invested with that kind of that amount of money, he's gonna get some pretty good returns, even if he throw into bonds. But that's not the value, right? The value is really like in terms of like tax management, estates management, like how do you prevent from like paying the tax agencies of the government versus paying yourself, right? It's those kind of things that people value, especially at their later stages. And the third thing I would say is that, you know, it's the easier way, right? You're not going to keep cash under your pillow anymore. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I would say, yeah, those are kind of like things that I see mostly.
Cool. Yeah, thanks for clarifying that, maneuvering the tax system, especially. Yeah, Greg.
Yeah. So let's just take the March scenario. The stock's down, what, 30%, 40%.
Right.
I'm really curious to see how your days were at the office.
I was in Colombia on vacation. But my buddy who was, but my buddy who was covering for me was having the time of his life. He just started working as a financial planner. And he was covering me. And normally, you know, nothing happens in March. So that's right after tax season, right after everything, you know, that's being done. So usually our business time is between January to like end of February. And then March is usually like nobody's going to call you because it's like closing down to like summer, like almost summer. So like people are like either working or like working on their summer plan. But then the market like hits rock bottom, right? So I have people emailing me. I have my buddy who was covering me emailing me, calling me. I had people who I added on the Chinese WeChat program. Like they also were calling me, you know, on that platform. It's basically like Instagram, but like for China. So like they were calling me like constantly, and like while I was on vacation, because like Wi-Fi was pretty scarce in Colombia, so I like whenever I go out and come back, like maybe I'll see like 5 to 10 different messages. I'll have to like get to them and speak with each one of them, like, you know, 20 to 30 minutes to kind of like calm them down and to kind of like make them kind of reassess, you know, what is happening versus, you know, like what they actually want to achieve, right? So fortunately, I would say only about like 5% to 10% of people like sold off what they had, and they didn't enjoy the, you know, rise back, you know, to the top right now. Some of them, you know, like exited and wanted to jump back in right away. So that's another challenge too. It was about like managing people's emotions versus actually managing, you know, the investment, because we know for sure that, you know, the portfolio managers are doing everything in their, you know, like power to, you know, not drop like the market. So I would say the most aggressive funds that I have year to date, they're only down by like 1%. So what that means is that when the market dropped 40, we did about like -7 to 8. because of the mechanism of the fund managers like are doing, like offsetting market volatilities, and also some advanced strategies like short selling options and things like that were in place. So long story short, managed to calm most of the clients down, and it was pretty positive. But you always have some of these clients where, they pull the trigger and like they get kind of upset about it, but it's too late afterwards, because, as much as I can talk to them about, thinking about this on a more, I would say, not non-emotional senses and more like looking long-term, it's really hard at that moment. Like, even I have a struggle because my portfolios were down 45% right in March, and my own money. And then I put more money into it, and then it dropped again. But now I'm net positive. So I'm happy that I stick through the process, because whenever I get kind of nervous and, kind of upset about, oh my God, Ethan, what the hell are you doing? I kind of go back to research, actual data, what is happening versus panic selling. So panic selling is the worst enemy of everybody. And I would say March leading into April was a pretty busy, emotional, and a lot of, back and forth with the clients, making sure that they're okay. So other than that, it's not as crazy. It's not as crazy.
On the flip side, we are 5 months further now. Pandemic is still going on, crisis, but the markets are at their all-time high now. Is that what's your take on that? This is how are people reacting to that now? Are people coming to they want to invest now? They see things are going great, even though we are in a worldwide crisis.
Right. My take on it is that we are really suspicious about if it's maintainable, but we know that long term wise, 1 year, 2 years from now, this is not going to be a huge issue. Whereas if we miss 5 best trading days within the year or 2 years, we are probably going to be down 5 to 10% from our actual earnings. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to do that, right? So and we know this because it's time tested, it shows itself even within this year, within the last 6 months, people who pulled out doing the job missed all of the good trading days, so they are net negative for the year. Mm-hmm. While they pulled out at the bottom. So I think it's a lot of different things, that's surrounding this whole increase. One, the government is pumping tons of money into the market to make them run as they are right now. But if you look at the data, most IT companies are having a great year. And they are helping lift the Nasdaqs and the Dow Joneses and S&P 500. So, if you look at it that way, they have net gains. So it's not just BS information out there, someone's pushing the market up. It's they have actual revenues. So that's a plus. Why we are suspicious is that, we've never seen something drop so fast, recover so quickly. Mm-hmm. The job was tremendously quick and the recovery even quicker, compared to 2008, where the job happened over 9 months. It's just incomparable. So we are looking at this on a more tactical basis, meaning that we have certain short selling orders in place to offset some of the market volatilities. We have a lot more strategies in the back end where we also deploy the mechanism to purchase currencies and gold and things like that as the occasion arises, depending on the market situation. So our view really is that it's a bit unstable right now, and we are doing our best to control the risk. But if you ask me, I think that is probably going to continue at least, into the election. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like my view, right? Like on the situation right now. But you know, like when it comes to it, like nobody really knows, right? And if I tell you that I know for sure, like I'll be bullshitting too, right? Yeah. So it's I don't think that battle is worth it. Like what I think it's important is that if you have your fundamentals, and if you have your fundamental strategies on like different situations, what the potential outcome potentially will be, and controlling your risks to the lowest, the market is gonna do what they're doing. Like, but we still have to find a way to maintain, you know, like some good real returns, not what's happening now, but like real returns a couple of years after now, when things are said and done, like, are you still okay with retirement? It's what we are paying attention to, right? So that's kind of like, yeah, my view on the whole thing.
Cool. Right. Yeah, Ethan, you said that you yourself suffered a 45% loss during the dip.
Yeah,
I mean that's ridiculous, man. That really sucks. But I'm glad you stuck through it and that you bought some on the dip. But has that given you a different perspective on how to relate to your clients? Because you've experienced it yourself, or did you already know beforehand what it was like? You knew it was going to happen eventually. Now we just have the practical experience.
So I would say yes to both. I already knew what was going to happen when market goes down like this. And the fact that I went under with them, well, I think every year, whenever things go down, like I went under with my clients anyway, because like we have very similar stuff. I use the same products that I use sometimes for my clients. So I know that, you know, I'm in it with them. At the same time, it's like market's going to do what they do. I need to be able to relate to them one way or the other in order to kind of like do them, I would say, service them in a good way. Because like if I cannot, you know, let them know that, you know what, I'm feel like I'm doing even worse than you, because most of my clients are not even down 10%. So I'm doing worse than them. And then, you know, I need them to understand that this is gonna, you know, go by, because I know that, you know, just like my understanding for my own money is that I'm not gonna touch my money for the next 2 years. So like what is happening now doesn't really matter to me. I want to know that, you know, 2 years time, like my money is still going to be okay. And if that's the case, then I'm fine. I know that that's going to happen. And same things to you, like now you're maybe down 6%, but you know, a year from now, like, you might not be down 6%. You might even be up 6%. Like who knows? But like, you know, instead of like worrying about, okay, well, should you sell or like, should you go do whatever now? Like, why don't you just wait till next year? Because, you know, at your best interest, cash is going to be the worst nightmare right now. With interest rate being this low, like cash is going to be the worst, you know, security for like years to come, because Central Reserve is probably not going to increase their rate for like another 2-3 years. Also in the Canadian side of things, we're not we don't see, you know, like a central bank increasing their rates for like the next year to 2 years. So that's why the guarantee investments are so low right now. Savings accounts are like record low at like 0.1%. You know, maybe a different story from in Suriname, but like here, like everything is super low. So like it's a punch to the gut to the savers. And the only way for us to really like move forward and be able to at least beat, inflation is that you need to have some kind of like growth that's maintainable, something like a dividend paying companies even, right? Like, you know, reasonable price and then like pay you reasonable like interest or, yeah, like that would be like really tough for savers. Another thing also is that the bonds are going downwards as well. So you can't even rely on bonds nowadays. If you have mutual funds that had like long-term bonds for like 30 to 50 years from like 5-10 years ago, like you're still okay, right? They're still paying decent, like 5-6%. But like right now they're issuing bonds for like 1-something%, right? So it's not feasible, and you know it's going to be like an equity you know, and yeah, like I don't know how to put it. But yes, definitely the experience led me to be able to relate more to the clients and let them know that, you know, I'm more aggressive than them. I'm losing more money than them, and I haven't sold my holdings just because I know that the overtime will come back and to give them or to service them, you know, like with that efficient, you know, like confidence, so that they won't, you know, sell at the low and buy back at the high. So that's my, like, I would say my motive is to make sure that they don't sell at a loss. And I'm pretty open about that with all my clients too. Some do listen, some don't. I'm just pretty, you know, straightforward with it, saying that, you know what, like, I know you bought this price, right now we are here, but I don't want you to lose money. So like, bear with it for like a couple more months, we'll talk again. And, you know, kind of like, handle them mentally, you know, make sure that they're okay and calm them down. Because otherwise, I can't stop them from selling. Because at the end of the day, it's their money. They do whatever they want. But I'm here to give them advice, and I do my best to stop them from doing something that they're not supposed to do. And that's why, yeah.
Yeah, so when a client sells against your advice, does that mean that the mm-hmm. fear of losing money is higher than the trust that they have in you personally? Or is it something else, you think?
I think on a behavioral science perspective, when you are losing money, it's the equivalent of you being chased by a guy with a knife in their hand. So they can relate the feeling of losing money to physical harm being experienced by an individual. So in that sense, I don't take anything personal, because I know that, you know, at the end of the day, like, if that calms him down, I'll do it. But like, I let them know that, you know, this is probably not the right move, but like, if this makes you feel better, right, like, I'll do it for you, but this is not my advice. And I also noted, you know, on my interactions with each client, and that, yeah, I don't think it's a trust issue. I do think it's a mental and like behavioral, like a science issue, which there are studies about it, like all over the internet too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't take it personally. Yeah.
And the people that panic sold, is it mostly the older crowd with more money to lose, or is it the younger crowd with less experience? They've never really experienced a recession.
I would say mix and somewhere in between. But I don't think it's so much about like being living through a market cycle like this. It is more about like individual basis. I have seniors who like just stuck through the process. Like, yeah, I know market is behaving a certain way, we just wait till next year, it's no big deal. Like, so you have people like that. And inside the same age group, you have, oh my God, Ethan, my kids are losing their job too. And the market is so low. I want to sell to keep some cash so that, you know, if they need help, I can help them. Right. So there's those. And there's also like, oh my God, the market is going down. Like, I'm really conservative. I'm not even going to talk to you. I'm going to call the trade desk and I'm selling myself. So you have all kinds of different people, for sure. But at the end of the day, it's like everyone is different. And that's why I have like a personalized plan for everyone, because I know that certain people behave a certain way. And I know that certain clients of mine are good with volatility, but others don't. So I will have like different strategies when like, you know, it comes to like managing their money, also like managing their emotions. So it depends.
Cool. So yeah, it's, there's no like.
It's like I'm a psychologist.
Yeah, in a sense, it's dealing more with emotions and calming people down than the technical side. Yeah, I'd like to make a quick segue. You mentioned previously you also had, when you were in Colombia, people on a WeChat channel. So yeah. Now predominantly handle local clients. How's the international clientele work for you? And lastly, to intertwine with that, how has your multilingual specialty has being able to speak Mandarin, Chinese, Dutch, English helped you in this position for international?
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah. So like the first one would be like, yes, mostly local like clients, because everyone needs to have like a, they call it like a social security number in order to open up a investment account. Bank accounts you can have, that's not an issue, but like to open up an investment account, like a brokerage account, you need to have like a tax number basically. So yes, only with locals, and it does not work with international like clients, although some people who had previously invested here in their retirement, for example, like a 401k equivalent in Canada, even if they become like a non-resident, but they're still Canadian, but they're living abroad, like they can still maintain that. So I have some clients that do have that. But yes, mostly just all Canadians, and I'm not able to work with like international investors. And then in terms of multilingual skills, I think that that does open up the dialogue. You know, like even though I'm not fluent in Spanish, like I can say a couple of words in Spanish, and like, you know, that does open up like a wider range of like conversations where, you know, those kind of also lead me to have a better understanding of the client, you know, feeling easy around me and willing to share more. So that's all, always a challenge between like, you know, like you meeting someone new versus like, you know, them opening up about, you know, what they want to achieve or what they have or like what they do, you know, things like that. In terms of like Mandarin and Cantonese, definitely helped me, you know, even getting my current role, because the previous branch manager was a Chinese branch manager, and he predominantly hired a lot more Asian advisors. So in order for me to work with these advisors' referrals, I must be able to speak Cantonese and Mandarin, where it lead to, I would say right now, 70%, you know, of my book of business is Chinese clients, you know, differentiating from like Mandarin and Cantonese, where 30% is predominantly English speaking. So that's kind of like a mix for now. No Spanish clients.
It's pretty interesting to see how that divide is between the languages. I didn't really expect that, yeah. Especially in Canada, being local and all, that right. You still have more than 50% in a foreign language.
Right. Yeah. So I think in terms of like geographic location, a lot of Asians like live in the neighborhood like before, so they still have their accounts here. So even though they move away from here, whenever we call, they still come back to do banking. So that's kind of like what led to, you know, like us having like a large pool of like a Chinese clientele. And especially out of the three branches that I managed before, two of them are like predominantly Chinese clients, because they were the only branches in this whole area that had Chinese advisors at work. So for the people that do speak English, but like maybe they're more comfortable, you know, in their own skin, you know, speaking Chinese, they will probably prefer more, you know, talking to like a Chinese advisor in the area. So that's kind of like how it got segregated that way, I would say. And then now, since I got a new branch manager that I'm working with, so now it's becoming a mix of everything. So No, like not specifically one or the other, but yeah.
Cool. Yeah, great.
All right. So from looking at you and comparing you to your superiors, your superior officer, superior manager, what are the differences in qualities between you and the higher ups? How can someone like you, who's already pretty high up the food chain, I guess, how can you get higher and higher and higher? What qualities would you need?
Okay. So I think you're talking about in terms of like maybe going to like a management or corporate. Is that what you mean? Or?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So in my line of business, we are actually not in it to going to management. So different level structures, like maybe we start from the basics. So if you are a teller at the branch, you're level one. So you have level one till like maybe level like 12. I'm at level 8, right? So what that means is that equivalent to a like the same level, like a I would say like an assistant branch manager. But because she is going to management, so like she is not a financial planner, for example. So when you're going to management, you only do like management positions or like coaching positions or like other positions. You mostly lead teams. My role is more to face like clients, client facing. So that's kind of like the difference. So for me to go up, it would be from financial planner going into investment advisor, where I will have the ability to use like alternative investments, purchase ETF stocks, short selling, margining accounts, group managed accounts and things like that. So that would be kind of like my pathway to go further, and that's kind of like a level 11 or level 10. So it skips a couple of levels there. But if you ask me whether, you know, like my differentiations to the management team, which is, let's say, my manager, it would be like they would be the people that have more experience coaching and leading a team, versus us would be more experiencing to like facing clients, coaching clients and talking to clients. So different route of like specialties, I would say.
It's a total different interface, basically, what you deal with.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah, it's different. So like, when you're a manager, maybe you're after, managing talent and making sure that, they do the right thing within compliance, that they are compliant and that they are, doing, what's in the client's best interest, and, to be able to coach them as best as you can, right? And then like from there, when you, I would say lead an effective team, then that's how you move up, right? And then at a certain level, maybe you have to do your MBA before you go to the next level. For me, it's more like basically manage my own clients to a point where I would say some of my colleagues, what happened was that because of how their portfolio grew, like individual clients having so much money that this platform was no longer feasible for certain clients. And when you have a lot of those clients, you move up to an investment advisor role where we're going to have more offerings, more diversification, better team of handling things, and then also that I will be able to kind of like hire my own staff to formulate a team around, my clients. So that would be kind of like a route, to like from now to like the next step, what that looks like.
Yeah, because I can imagine you can only manage so many clients before it because it starts getting way too many phone calls. And you said now I believe you have around 200 clients. At what point would it be just too much to handle?
200 clients, 130 families. I think a study has been done. So the best number to get to is 250 families. 250 families, meaning approximately 500 something clients. Right, that's kind of like the best number to get to. But a lot of us, in my team, like they have more than that. So some people have like 2,000 clients. So like how they manage it, like I've seen people that, basically conducts like 5-6 meetings a day, nonstop, every day. So yeah, so that's kind of like how they maintain it, like certain, like to a certain degree, right? And then yeah, I would say that would be.
Yeah, you're calling that number like 2,000 clients. Doesn't that kind of bring you out of touch with people? How do you even remember who you're dealing with and keeping that relationship going?
So that's where discipline comes into place, right? So like I said before, every interaction, I have notes on what we spoke about, what kind of decision we made, whether it be on taxes, investment, and the plan. So for each of my families, I have like a group of notes, under there, then that that's kind of like how I make sure that I remember everything. So like before my meetings or before my conversations, I'll have like a, you know, quick review on what we spoke about so far, and then kind of like just go from there. So it's more like I would say, for me, because I started doing it since I started working, so it's kind of like second nature to me. So that's mostly how we organize things around there. And I think the good thing about it is like, maybe 2,000 people is like a reach, maybe 1,500. You know, if you have 1,500, that means that you have at least like 750 families. And, you know, if you look at that number, that means that every year you at least have to, you know, have like two meetings a day, right? If you're not taking vacation. So, you know, one family would be one meeting, right? So 750 family divided by two, around like 375. And then if you do three meetings a day, you know, in a year, then you're covering everybody. So it's actually not that, it's not that hard, I would say. And with the support to technology where, you know, some people might not want to travel. So we have like, you know, Zoom call, for example, right? To like meet with these different clients and make sure that we service them to the best that we can. So yeah, I mean, it, loss of touch, yes, potentially, but like we can probably, at least from my peers that actually have that many clients, and they are not missing anything. Like it, yeah. It's crazy.
in a way, would you say that emotional detachment is kind of a good thing? Because not being too invested in, you know, the people and just having a summary of notes, seeing, okay, this is what's going on, and then being too engaged with that without, you know, being emotionally invested.
Yes. That is one of the more important things. Or actually, you know, when I do my licensing exams, so those are like the things that they, you know, explicitly like teach you on is basically be as unbiased as possible. Mm-hmm. Because if you are using emotions and your biases and, you know, other things, you know, surrounding, you know, your decisions, then like you're not serving the client at their best interest. You want to be as, you know, like as neutral as possible when it comes to like a client, like dealing with clients or like talking to clients, you know, whether it be like on investments or on planning on other things, like we just more of a, okay, I hear what you're saying, and then use our knowledge to like guide them the right way as in a sense. So yeah, try to be as unbiased as possible.
So I assume there'd also be a policy as in not being allowed to handling like family or close friends. Is there something like that in place?
There is none like that in place, but like, I just don't deal with friends because I think that it's really hard for me to do it. So like when they meet me for business, it will be one phase, but then when they meet me outside, it will be another phase. So like for me, it will be really hard, right? So and that does not mean that, you know, like when I have clients, it's strictly business. There's also like personal side to it, like they do become friends over time. But like for me to deal with, like for example, my classmates, it would be no, I don't want to do that. Yeah, I wouldn't want to do that. No. Yeah.
All right. Cool. So I gotta ask this question because the impression that people from Suriname have of Wall Street and investing is obviously the famous movie with drugs and hookers, The Wolf of Wall Street. Right. So tell me, how much of it is fake and exaggerated, and how much of it is actually true?
I think that this true in a lot of things, like because what I feel is that back in those days where there is no do not call list, right, where you don't get fined for like cold calling people out of the blue and selling them things, I think that most of the things were probably true, but I cannot you know, like speak on their behalf, because one, I never work in New York, so I don't know how it actually goes down. Two, from my personal experience, that kind of exaggeration never led me anywhere. I never really used that kind of exaggerations when I needed to, for example, present an investment, like a product in front of a client. Three, for me, it was more like I'm pretty much of a, I would say that I'm pretty compliant when it comes to like things that I should and should not say. And like one of the secret shoppers that the TD sent me could verify that, because we get tested by like secret shoppers from the licensing organization and also from my own companies, like every now and then. So they would basically observe what we say, what we do in terms of like, for example, false promising on like return numbers and exaggerating and things like that. So I think that so far I never had a problem. And I am a person that's very scared into like getting into trouble too. So that kind of helped. Yeah, I would say for me, not really, like I wouldn't say that that's true in my career, but I can see it happening, you know, like 20 years or 30 years ago, from people wanting to sell a stock to someone that don't know any better. Like, I can't see that from happening. Yes.
Okay, so there's actually active company policy to make sure this kind of stuff does not happen.
They will send people to test you, like secret shoppers. Yeah, so they do have that.
All right, great. So what is your average colleague, just the average guy in finance, what does that mm-hmm. person do? Are they just kind of normal guys? They just go home to their wives, watch sports? Or are they a cut above the rest, just smarter than the rest, just way more into the stuff they do? How do they differ?
Like from my experience, most of the people that, you know, are in my line of work are either specialize in one thing or the other. And it goes well beyond their working hours too. So that's kind of fascinating to see. Like for me, I like to work overtime, not knowingly, like work overtime. But like for me, it's more about, you know, like reading the principles and the strategies and the market updates, and also following like investment news. So that for me is like 24/7, right? But I have some colleagues where they go to the extent of like, you know, having a full 8 hours day and then doing additional studies on like, for example, like estate management, taxations and things like that. And some people, they actually study the market while they're doing their full-time job because like they dabble in the market too. But oftentimes what I see is that the people who get promoted quite quickly or the ones that have a keen interest, you know, into, you know, the things that we do, right, in various like specializations, and the ones that, you know, kind of like stay behind are the ones that are feeling comfortable quite easily. There's nothing wrong with that, because like maybe we're making about the same kind of money, but like some people just like more comfortable doing, you know, XYZ, whereas certain people want to try ABCD. I'm probably in the middle, because like I'm not too hardcore tactical stuff, but I'm not also like too hardcore into like staying in place, you know, just knowing what I know is enough to get me by. Like I'm also not so, like every year I'm doing some kind of licensing, but like not to the hardcore folks. Like, okay. But yeah, that's kind of like my view on the things. Yeah.
So if you keep improving with every year, what do you plan on doing after, let's just say 10 years, 15 years? What does your future look like?
For me, it's more about basically accumulating clients for me. And then like in the meantime, like accumulating more knowledge to support these clients. Because wherever I see a challenge, I try to mitigate that challenge as soon as possible, whether it be like a knowledge issue or like a soft skill issue or some other things, right? So for me, it's more like how to be better every year. And 10 years from now, maybe I'm still doing this same thing, but like maybe in another firm, maybe in another structure. But I think long-term wise, this is a pretty good career. People make anywhere between like 60 to like, 600,000, like at my level. But there's also, more potential into going to like the millions, with the next steps, right? So it really depends. It really depends. Some people never make the jump and some people make the jump early. But like for me, it's like still wait and see. For me, it's more like let me do what I'm able to do now and do it the best that I can first before going to the next step. So that's kind of like how I see it. Yeah.
No, I think that's great. And it seems like you're really enjoying it, what you're doing, trying to, help the people and help share like that financial security in a sense for the future and retirement.
Yeah.
It's been an awesome talk with you, Ethan. I do have one little question, totally off topic. Really curious.
Yeah, go ahead. I love this off topic stuff.
I see behind you something says Seneca, a certificate or a sign. Is that a reference to Tao of Seneca, like Stoicism or something like that?
Oh, no. This is my school.
Oh, it's a school.
Yeah, that's my school. And that's my finance diploma from Ontario.
Awesome. Do you know how they got that name, Seneca?
No, I have no clue. I just know that they have a lot of foreign students. That's what I know.
Interesting, because from my understanding, at least I haven't dived really deep into it, but I have encountered the name previously before in like self-development. So I thought maybe you encountered it during your self-development phase.
No.
It's just like about stoicism, showing no emotions and just being able to go through the pain, which actually fits the profile kind of dealing with all that. So
thank you.
I was kind of curious to that.
That's just my school. But yes, I probably did like some kind of training around that, like what you said, but no formal like education regarding to like controlling my emotions, no. I just try not to get pissed at any situation. And it's great, when you can do that, dealing with women is definitely something that's needed. Maybe Greg can, tell us more about that too, but yeah.
Hey man, you're the guy who's basically married, right? So you should be giving advice.
Yes, and like I think it's good and bad. Just making like it work is usually the best experience. So nothing to exaggerate over there.
All right, great, Ethan. It's been awesome. Fun. It's been really amazing. If people wanna ask you some questions, where's the best place to find you?
I think the best way, let me see, I never go to my website, but like you can probably find
a website.
let me see.
And do you have any like final thoughts you like to, like a knowledge bomb you like to drop on us, or just anything random before we close up?
Yeah, so I think before we close. It's like financialplanners.td.com/eason.yeah/. So that's it. Like you can find me and you can contact me and you can just, send me a message on there and then like it'll get to me. But final thoughts, I mean like very much appreciated, you guys inviting me to this. This is my first time, talking on the podcast. Again, all personal like opinions and like thoughts surrounding, everything that I spoke about. I do not represent like TD within this podcast, but more like a friendly chat. But in case anything, like in terms of, immigrating here, I do answer a lot of questions from like folks that come here from Suriname, like, you know, how they can, what do you expect from like studying here, expectation of like working after studying here, and what they need to do to like stay, like, you know, as a, you know, Surinamese here in Toronto, like if you need some help, like you can let me know and then I'll get you, you know, information that you need, kind of like that. But otherwise, yeah, stay awesome.
No, that's awesome, you offering that as well. Could you repeat that website again? Because we'll put it in the description, but you just cut off when you were browsing for it.
Okay. So maybe I can type it in, right?
Yeah, then we'll put it in the show notes as well. And while Ethan's doing that, I'm going to, I guess, close off. Thanks for joining. It's been awesome. financialplanners.td.com/Ethan.ye. And
okay, yeah. I just saw Tim's message. Oh, so it's okay, Timothy Lee. Okay, I know this guy.
Oh.
his brother like shits on me in basketball, so yeah. That's how I know this guy. Maurice, you know, it's killing me on the fort always. So anyways, yeah. And I think there was this one time when I was like 12 or something that I went camping with Tim. He didn't know me at the time, but like him and Jeannie, like his cousin, and like what's the other guy? Marvin. Yes, we went camping. So yeah, that's how I remember him. But anyways, yes, Overbridge, where we ate some of those, you know, cannibalistic fishes. What are those called? Piranhas. Yes,
what
exactly.
A roundabout reunion, I must say. And I think that's a good place to leave that.
All right.
This has been the Casual Compos. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. The podcast will be available on Spotify, iTunes, the regular podcast places, probably on YouTube and TreeSpeak. That's the new blockchain platform we're exploring. And we'll see you in the next one. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye, guys.